Two Bush administration officials who inspected cleanup operations in Prince William Sound 5 days after the Exxon Valdez oil spill have told the president that response to the accident was wholly insufficient. Today's Washington Post reports that Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner and Environmental Protection Agency Administrator William Riley said that planning for and response to the spill by the oil industry and the federal government was unequal to the task. In a strongly worded 37-page report, Skinner and Riley have urged the government and the oil industry to draft realistic worst-case scenarios for handling future disasters, but they warn that major oil spills may not be avoidable in the future. In Anchorage today, the National Transportation Safety Board begins its fifth day of hearings into the cause of the March 24th spill. Yesterday, testimony focused on evidence that the captain of the Exxon Valdez was drinking before the accident. The NTSB board heard from the ship's chief engineer, who said he saw the captain drinking vodka in Valdez bars several hours before boarding the ship. Robert Hawk of Alaska Public Radio reports.
Like any good sailor on shore leave, Chief Engineer Jerzy Klawacki says it felt good to get away from the ship when he, the radio man, and Captain Joseph Hazelwood set foot in Valdez the afternoon of March 23rd. Klawacki told National Transportation Safety Board investigators the group of three first had a leisurely lunch at a pizza parlor before splitting up near a supermarket. But investigator Eric Sager wanted to hear more about a rendezvous later in the day at the Pipeline Club, a local bar. Sager had to prod a bit, but finally got around to the obvious question.
Had you and the captain begun drinking?
I had a drink, yes.
Did the captain?
Yes, he did.
What were you drinking?
I was drinking gin and tonic.
Do you recall what Captain Hazelwood was drinking?
I believe he was drinking vodka.
Chief Klawacki says he and the captain may have had three drinks at the Pipeline Club, but he wasn't certain. He says after the radio officer joined them for a beer, they all went back to the restaurant for more pizza to go. He told investigators that while the pizzas were cooking, Captain Hazelwood went to another bar next door and had another drink. The men headed back to the tanker just before 8 p.m. The vessel ran aground about 4 hours later. Klawacki testified neither he nor the captain was intoxicated during or before the wreck, and when asked if he knew the captain may have had an alcohol dependency, the chief said he had heard some mention of it in the past, but had seen no evidence of alcohol abuse by Hazelwood. But later in yesterday's hearing, Exxon Shipping President Frank Iarossi acknowledged that Hazelwood has gone through a company-sponsored alcohol rehabilitation program, and that one of the captain's job performance reviews had recommended that the captain be given temporary shore duty. Iarossi says fleet executives decided to keep Hazelwood in his tanker command. But when pressed by investigators, the Exxon president revealed that Captain Hazelwood is currently a defendant in a lawsuit brought by a former crew member. Iarossi says the shipmate suffers from a nervous condition allegedly brought on by serving under Hazelwood.
The allegations themselves were looked into very carefully. The individual named 7 or 8 people who he said we're aware of the circumstances. To mine, all 7 or 8 were interviewed, and none of them supported the individual's position. Not one individual supported it. So and the matter is still up for litigation. I don't know. I want to talk too much more about it.
Okay.
The board reached further, pressing Iarossi about Exxon's policy in general when it comes to combating drug and alcohol abuse among its thousands of employees. Iarossi says he personally worked long and hard on a letter mailed last year to everyone in the company, but NTSB members wanted to know if a warning on paper is good enough.
Are you satisfied that this purpose is being achieved throughout your company?
I think our results are not totally satisfactory. We'd like to have perfect results from it, but I think certainly we've made major strides in upgrading the professional management and leadership capabilities of our people.
One policy that was changed before the oil spill is a ban on table wine, customarily served aboard Exxon tankers at holiday dinners. Other testimony yesterday left some questions about events immediately prior to the accident. The tanker's second mate challenged earlier testimony. He doubts the autopilot being left on contributed to the accident. These hearings are expected to continue through tomorrow morning, with more testimony expected on the cleanup effort launched immediately after the spill. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Hawk in Anchorage.
Exxon and Texaco have started drilling an exploratory well near the Chesapeake Bay in hopes of finding oil or gas. When completed, the well will plunge 12,000 feet into a giant underground basin formed millions of years ago when the European and African continents broke away from North America. Environmental groups say they're concerned about the possibility of damage to the fragile Chesapeake area in light of the Valdez spill. Van Williamson of member station WSCL reports.
The site is in Virginia near the Potomac River, about 50 miles from the Chesapeake Bay. Gail Morgan, spokeswoman with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, says Maryland, Virginia, and Pennsylvania have already poured millions into a program to rid the bay of pollution. She fears the money would be wasted if an accident occurred.
We just think that the risk is going to be too great to sacrifice this wonderful environment for a few days' supply of gasoline.
Texaco spokesman John Ambler says the company is aware of residents' concerns, but thinks fears of a Valdez-type disaster are off base.
I guess the important thing to note is that there are absolutely no plans to transport oil or gas via water. It would all be done through existing pipeline systems.
He says it's cheaper to ship by land than by sea. Gail Morgan says she's heard of Texaco's intention, but she's not convinced.
Pipelines seem to be safer, but they are by no means safe and secure, and the risk of what we have to lose is just so far outweighs any possible benefit that we could get from this oil.
Morgan says there is no guarantee that Texaco won't decide later to ship oil by barge or that other companies won't flock to the area and sink their own wells. The Maryland Department of Natural Resources is watching the operation because Maryland sits on top of the Taylorsville Basin, too. Petroleum geologist Ken Schwartz says there is only a slim chance that oil will be found.
It is a long shot, and it is very expensive, and it's risk money that oil companies, and that's the kind of money they have to spend for risk businesses like this. It's certainly something I wouldn't recommend that the state be involved in drilling to use the taxpayers' money.
Texaco puts the chances of discovering oil or gas at 1 in 20. Schwartz agrees and says it could be as high as 1 in 50. He says companies like Texaco are having to look at more marginal sites like this one because the giant domestic fields are drying up. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation says it will try to monitor the operation for the 4 to 5 months it's expected to take, but since the site is on private property, they have to rely on reports from the Environmental Protection Agency. For National Public Radio, I'm Van Williamson in Salisbury, Maryland.
It's All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. The response to the Alaska oil spill has been slow, confused, unequal to the task, and wholly insufficient. That's the message to President Bush from Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner and Environmental Protection Agency Administrator William Riley after their study of the cleanup effort by both the government and the Exxon Corporation. In Valdez yesterday, the chief engineer of the Exxon Valdez testified that he was drinking with Captain Joseph Hazelwood just before the tanker left port, and Exxon company officials faced charges from stockholders yesterday at the company's annual meeting in New Jersey, including a demand that the top management resign because of the spill. This morning I talked with Charles Sitter in New York. He's an Exxon senior vice president, a member of the management team. Although Exxon has spent so far $115 million on the cleanup, the state of Alaska says not 1 mile of beach has yet to be satisfactorily cleaned. Charles Sitter says Exxon has been working on the dirtiest beaches first, and he isn't worried.
We're going to clean up the job however long it takes, and we've set no monetary limit on how much money we'll spend to do the job.
Is the damage at this point to the wildlife in the Sound perhaps a bit more severe than you had thought? The figures coming from Alaska yesterday indicate that 11,000 birds, 700 sea otters have been killed, 20 bald eagles, and the numbers could be, because they can't find all the dead birds or otters, the numbers could be five times higher than that.
Well, those sound like extremely wild numbers to me. I can tell you those we know of. We know of 300 birds, roughly, and 70 otters that are known to be dead. There may be more than that, but the people are climbing all over the beaches looking for them, so it's unlikely that the numbers you mentioned are even close. I think it's well mentioned also that there's no evidence at all of any fish kill up there, nor of any seals nor any sea lions being killed. And people ought to keep in mind when they talk about this that there have been no human deaths either when they compare it to other catastrophes around the world.
But there is evidence that the oil is moving into the food chain, that fish are ingesting the oil and that birds who eat the fish are having trouble. It could move all the way up to the bears in Alaska.
Well, there's speculation that that might happen. There's no evidence that we've seen that that's happening. In fact, the salmon season just opened on the 16th of this month, just a few days ago, and the salmon catch has been excellent in the first day, and no evidence of any oil on any of the fish or in them.
I want to ask you about the boycott against Exxon. 18,000 credit cards returned so far. Is that correct?
That's roughly correct, yes.
Out of 7 million.
Right.
What is your feeling about that? Do you think that the cardholders are overreacting against what would have been their oil company?
Well, I can understand people being angry and frustrated. We're angry and frustrated about this whole thing. And people are seeking a way to vent their anger, and that's understandable. But I believe a boycott is an ill-conceived and a non-productive way to express oneself. First of all, this was an accident. Nobody set out to do it. It was not a malicious act. Secondly, the dealers, who are the people most affected by the boycott, have nothing whatsoever to do with the accident. They can no way be held culpable. And it doesn't do a thing to clean up the mess. It's a totally non-constructive kind of move.
I want to ask you about Captain Hazelwood. One of the crew testified yesterday in Valdez that he was drinking with Captain Hazelwood in two bars just before leaving that evening. Has Exxon put into force a program that would deny the crew of a tanker the right to their same job after they've been through an alcohol rehabilitation program?
We've announced that policy change. The details of its implementation are still being worked out.
Do you think it was wrong for the company to have a policy that would guarantee his job?
That would guarantee his job?
After rehabilitation.
It's a judgment that each of us have to make, and we're making the judgment that that trade-off has to be placed a different cut than it was before. There are certain jobs where you simply cannot afford to allow that to happen.
But what direct steps are you taking to make sure that no one who is drinking is at the helm of an Exxon tanker?
There will be a number of steps, including unannounced testing and certainly inspection, and that will begin with not just people on ship, but that will include top management people.
Do you understand the frustration of many people in this country, including some of your stockholders yesterday at that meeting and the people who have mailed back their credit cards, frustration with Exxon? And what would you like to tell those people who perhaps don't understand what it's like to be responsible for such a large corporation in this situation?
Well, I not only understand the frustration, I share it. And the employees of Exxon are, as a group, share it and feel very deeply concerned about what has happened. We are in a business that involves risks. It was a serious accident. It was a bad event. But we believe, behaved responsibly in accepting the responsibility for it, gotten after the job, and marshaled what is really a huge logistical undertaking in a very remote location to cure the problem. And a great deal of progress has been made. Most of the oil has been cleaned off the water. The bulk of the beach cleanup, shore cleanup, is well underway. We've marshaled 7,000 people, 700 ships, 56 aircrafts, and 100 miles of boom. We've protected the hatcheries successfully. It's hard to see what more can be done.
You know, you mentioned that it was an accident. Do you agree with the terminology that it was a preventable accident?
Well, you can say all accidents are preventable. There was nothing wrong with the vessel design or its condition, so it was human error.
With regard to the tanker design, in the Village Voice this week, Steve Ross of the New Jersey Environmental Lobby said Exxon was allowed to build an unsafe tanker without a double bottom and to put a drunk in charge of a floating bomb.
Well, people can write what they want in a democracy, but the ship was not an unsafe vessel. It conformed fully to U.S. standards. It was built in the U.S., the U.S. design regulations. It was in good condition, and there were no mechanical malfunctions. What happened is that some people did not do what they were supposed to do, and it ran on the ground. You can't blame that on the ship.
Has there been any talk among Exxon's management about punitive damages in Prince William Sound?
Well, punitive damages have been raised, but it's hard to see why one would be considered a subject for punitive damages when the event was an accident, not some malicious event.
I read in a magazine just this month, Lawrence Rawls' salary, the CEO of Exxon, it's $1,419,000. And I was thinking about an Indian family in a fishing village on Prince William Sound who depend totally on the wildlife from the sound, trying to figure out who Mr. Rawl is and what's going on with Exxon and why their life has been totally changed. Perhaps not necessarily so, but they think it's totally changed. And does Mr. Rawl think, and the Exxon management think about people like that?
You bet we do. In fact, the very first day we had a claims man on the scene up there, we now have 60 people up there handling claims from local residents for either property damage or loss of income. And as of yesterday, while we had distributed over $6 million to some 586 people who have filed such claims, and we're continuing to raise that number every day. A lot of the losses you hear talked about are speculative, is what will be lost if. And as I mentioned, the salmon season is open and is a good season. And a lot of people, of course, are working for us right now on the cleanup and making attractive incomes doing that.
But isn't that the whole point? What would be lost if? Isn't that the real concern about Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska? What happens 10 years from now? What if that way of life is gone?
I think there's very little likelihood that way of life is going to be gone. We've done, in cooperation with a number of environmental organizations, toxicity tests in the water column up there where the water, the oil has passed through. And they're virtually unmeasurable, hundreds of times below the thresholds that would be important. We're not finding any evidence of contamination in the plankton or in the fish life. So a lot of what you hear are speculations about what could happen, but not what has happened, or is there any evidence that's going to happen. In fact, one has to remember that that sound flushes out completely every 20 days. The tide action up there is extremely strong, and Mother Nature does quite a cleaning job on it.
You know, I saw on ABC's Nightline an Exxon scientist talking about those toxicity studies in the column of water, and Dennis Kelso of Alaska's Environmental Commission said that that study was entirely too premature, and he wasn't willing to accept any of it at this point.
Well, I don't think Mr. Kelso is willing to accept much, but the studies will continue, and until everybody's satisfied. It's one thing if you do the studies and you find out you got good results. People say, I don't believe them, and if you do the studies and got bad results, well, then some of those same people will say, you've got to do something about it. So you have to deal, I think, with the evidence and rather than simply the opinions about the evidence.
Charles Sitter, a senior vice president of Exxon, a member of the management team with that company, he talked with us from his office in New York.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition. French President and Mrs. Mitterrand arrived today in Maine at the usually serene compound of that accusation came yesterday at National Transportation Safety Board hearings to determine the causes of the spill. There were also charges that Alyeska, the oil company pipeline consortium, never had a chance to clean up the spill. From member station KSKA in Anchorage, Robert Hawk reports.
Officials with Alyeska Pipeline Service Company defended their plan for dealing with tanker oil spills. As owner of the pipeline and tanker dock, Alyeska is required to provide initial response to spills. William Howitt, the company's engineering manager, says Alyeska's contingency plan has always met with favor from the Federal Bureau of Land Management and state officials.
The BLM and the Department of Natural Resources through 1988 reviewed and approved the plan on a yearly basis.
Howitt acknowledged that the worst-case scenario in the plan envisions 200,000 barrels of oil being spilled in the relative calm waters of summer. The Exxon Valdez lost at least 260,000 barrels in late winter. Howitt also conceded that even under the best of circumstances, every cleanup method mentioned in the plan would not have been enough to keep the oil off the coastline. but he says they did the best they could on the Valdez spill. Alaska Commissioner of Environmental Conservation Dennis Kelso disagrees. He says Alyeska failed to provide, among other things, enough oil skimmers and containment boom at the site of the wreck.
There is also basically a long list of items which Alyeska agreed to do, for example, to mobilize teams, which we saw no evidence of occurring.
Kelso is especially upset about an ocean-going barge called for in the plan for hauling cleanup equipment to spills. At the time of the March 24th wreck, the barge was out of commission with its equipment on shore. It arrived at the spill 15 hours after the accident. The contingency plan calls for cleanup equipment to arrive within 3 to 5 hours. While it's been their practice in the past to have it standing by, Alyeska's Howitt argued that there's no requirement in the plan for the barge to be just sitting around with cleanup equipment already loaded. As far as the delay in getting to the spill, Howitt says the plan is flexible.
There are no response times specifically required. The response times mentioned in all the scenarios are estimated times.
Testimony today, the last day, will be exclusively from Coast Guard officials. Formal findings of this inquiry are not expected to be released by the full National Transportation Safety Board until later this summer. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Hawk in Anchorage.
In Anchorage, Alaska, the National Transportation Safety Board has just concluded 5 days of hearings into the wreck of the Exxon oil tanker Valdez. The board heard from Coast Guard commanders, radar technicians, Exxon executives, and crew members of the ship. As Robert Hawk reports, the testimony, which ended yesterday, provided the most detailed and compelling account of the events leading up to the accident.
Some observers compared these hearings with investigations of the Challenger space shuttle explosion and the sinking of the Titanic. Others are calling it Spillgate because the mess goes beyond the March 24th wreck of the Exxon Valdez and oiled beaches of Prince William Sound into the boardrooms of one of the biggest corporations in the country and to the state and federal governments. Third Mate Greg Cousins was the man in control of the supertanker when it crashed into Bligh Reef. He was unauthorized to be running the tanker in those waters. Cousins told of spinning the tanker's wheel hard to the right before phoning below deck to warn his boss, Joseph Hazelwood.
I called the captain, and I said to him at that time, I think we're in serious trouble. And even during that conversation, at the end of that conversation, is when I felt the initial shock to the vessel.
Some in the audience complained investigators didn't hit hard enough or ask enough follow-up questions, and the inquiry was at times mired in technical details. But not when First Mate James Kunkel took the stand. He painted a grim picture of a midnight shipwreck.
I don't mind telling you that at that moment I knew that my world would never be the same again. I feared for my life at the time. I wondered if I'd see my wife again. And I had no idea of how bad this was, but it was the worst thing I'd ever been involved in.
A volatile issue here was the matter of the captain's drinking and whether his judgment was impaired by alcohol. It was only after much questioning that investigators got the tanker's chief engineer, Jerzy Glowacki, to describe what he and the captain were doing at a Valdez bar the afternoon prior to the oil spill.
Had you and the captain begun drinking?
I had a drink, yes.
Did the captain?
Yes, he did.
What were you drinking?
I was drinking gin and tonic.
Do you recall what Captain Hazelwood was drinking?
I believe he was drinking vodka.
Several vodkas, according to Glowacki, although he says he's not exactly sure how many. The chief went on to testify that the captain went to another bar later and had more to drink. The captain was in his cabin when his tanker went astray. Sobriety testing on Hazelwood 11 hours after the accident pegged his blood alcohol level at 0.06, in excess of Coast Guard rules for operating a commercial vessel. In testimony on Thursday, Exxon Shipping President Frank Iarossi explained that Hazelwood had gone through a company-monitored alcohol rehabilitation program, and in their follow-up, fleet executives decided that the captain was fit for sea duty. Coast Guard officers, who were among the first to respond to the tanker accident, said they could smell alcohol on the captain's breath from 4 feet away, and they said they became concerned when they spotted Hazelwood casually standing on the bridge, smoking cigarettes, even while the tanker was enveloped in potentially explosive vapors. Hazelwood and his attorney refused to appear at this inquest, but he faces misdemeanor criminal charges in court next month and a possible grand jury indictment. A major topic here was the oil industry's immediate response to what turned out to be the worst oil spill in U.S. history. A contingency plan called for cleanup response to any large spill within 3 to 5 hours. It took Exxon and Alyeska Pipeline 15 hours to arrive with the first load of cleanup gear, skimmer boats, and containment boom required under the plan. Officials with Exxon and Alyeska tried to defend their actions by saying the contingency plan for dealing with oil spills has been approved routinely by the state for the past 11 years, but they acknowledged that the emergency plan was drawn up, assuming daylight conditions and better weather than when the tanker dumped nearly 11 million gallons of North Slope crude oil into Prince William Sound. William Howitt is the manager of engineering for Alyeska.
We learn from every drill. We learn from every oil spill.
Although much was learned during this testimony, one subject not addressed was the environmental damage from the spill. At least 800 miles of Alaska coastline remain polluted. Several fisheries have been shut down, and the oil has killed thousands of seabirds and other animals. Even though it lasted 5 days, this was only a board of inquiry. Investigators mentioned at the onset there will be no findings of liability. Conclusions from the full National Transportation Safety Board are not expected to be made public for many months, perhaps not until next year. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Hawk in Anchorage.
The state of Alaska literally is trying to put the best face on its efforts to attract tourists in the wake of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Robert Hawk of Alaska Public Radio reports.
In what may be one of the more unusual public relations gambits ever seen in Alaska, the sultry allure of Marilyn Monroe is being compared to the worst oil spill in U.S. history. With permission from Monroe's estate, Exxon and the Alaska Visitors Association have put together a campaign that shows the image of Monroe with and then without the prominent beauty mark that graced the actress's chin. She appeared in movies like Bus Stop, Some Like It Hot, and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. Rod Bradley is the Anchorage ad man whose agency dreamed up the campaign.
We start out the commercial by saying that we've changed this picture of this legendary beauty to make a point, and her beauty mark is missing. We put the beauty mark back on in the television commercial. It comes back on, and it says, unless you looked very close, you probably didn't realize that her beauty mark was missing, but she was just as beautiful as ever, and that's the same thing with the oil spill.
Tourism is one of the top three industries in Alaska, along with oil and fishing, and tourist attractions all over the state have been losing business since the 11 million gallon oil spill. Bradley says Exxon is pumping $3.5 million into the campaign. TV spots will air in what he calls top markets for luring visitors to Alaska, 13 cities on the West Coast, parts of the Midwest, and the Southeast U.S. The campaign will also use a national cable syndicate and will take print ads in dozens of major newspapers. Bradley says they want to tell people planning trips to Alaska that there's a lot more to the state than Prince William Sound.
Right now there are cancellations down in southeast Alaska, even though it's 1,000 miles from any of the spill impact. I mean, there are people who are canceling their visit to Mount McKinley thinking that it's been spoiled by the oil spill. I mean, it's just that kind of ridiculous situation, but people just don't understand the geography of Alaska.
But some people here have already been offended by the ads, which will run for the next 4 weeks. Marilyn Monroe died 27 years ago from a drug overdose, and editorials in local newspapers this week called it bizarre that Exxon and the Alaska tourist industry would use a dead sex symbol to take people's minds off images of dead birds, dead sea otters, and dead beaches. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Hawk in Anchorage.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has called on Exxon to form teams to capture bald eagles affected by the Alaska oil spill. Alaska has the largest population of bald eagles in North America. 2,000 to 3,000 pairs nest in the Prince William Sound area alone. Dr. Patrick Reddick of the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota was in Alaska to study the effects of the spill on eagles and other birds of prey. He says eagles are at risk from the spill even though they are not water birds.
The birds of prey, particularly the eagles, are affected by the oil spill because they feed regularly on the carrion or the carcasses of animals that have washed up on shore. And right now, in the wake of the oil spill, there are a large number of such affected animals, and the eagles are scavenging them with great regularity.
So that means that the eagles are eating oil and oil-soaked flesh.
That's correct. They're eating a lot of it, plus they manage to get a lot of it on their feathers as they are working the carcass of the animal over. Plus, there's just a tremendous amount of oil on the ground up there, so anytime the birds spend on the beaches, they are absorbing oil into their feet and their feathers.
Is a primary danger to the eagles that they are ingesting something toxic and eating the oil?
Yes, it's an extreme danger. We don't know the absolute quantities, but our observations are that it takes very little of that heavy Alaskan crude oil to cause the death of the eagle. And so far, about 40 eagles have been recovered dead from the area around Kodiak Island and up in the northern part of the sound. And we've had to deal with about another 9 live ones clinically that were very, very sick from the effects of the oil.
Well, now, what's the point of capturing these eagles? Could you actually help them, or do you just need to know what's happening to them?
We need to know both things. We saw in the flight that we made on the Sound last Tuesday, we saw a fairly large number of eagles that had evidence of oil on their feathers. Several of them were sitting in treetops, hanging their wings out as if they were trying to dry them, and yet what they had on them was oil and not water. Our success in treating them depends entirely on how early in the intoxication process that they are brought into a facility for treatment. And so that's one aspect of this whole program, is to try to assess some of these birds in the field and save them and or get them in captivity in time to treat them. But beyond that, we need to know just how heavily oiled some of these birds are, because they are all nesting right now, and it takes as little as 1 microliter of oil on an egg to kill the embryo inside. And so I feel it's important that we assess these birds and get some idea of what the impact of this is going to be on the reproductive activity of the eagles in the sound.
Do I understand you to say that a smear of oil on the shell of an egg could kill the egg?
That's correct. Just a small drop of the oil on the egg will penetrate through the eggshell and kill the embryo inside.
If you were to capture a number of eagles, what do you do with these eagles when you've got them in captivity?
Well, right now there's a facility being built with support from Exxon in the Anchorage area, which will provide long-term support for a fairly large number of eagles that are brought into captivity. So the birds will be treated immediately by cleaning any oil from the exterior, and then they will be given fluids and other chemotherapeutic agents, drugs of one sort or another, that help them clear the oil from the system and recover the function of their liver and their kidneys. And once they're back in a state of health, they will be turned into the holding pens and retained there until such time as the oil has been sufficiently cleaned up in the sound to release them back to the wild. We expect that may take over a year.
Dr. Patrick Reddick, director of the Raptor Center, he spoke to us from his office at the University of Minnesota.
More than 3,000 people are washing the oily shores of Prince William Sound in Alaska. They've arrived from all over the country to help clean up after the Exxon Valdez, which in March spilled more than 11 million gallons of oil into the sound. Exxon has had to find housing for many of these workers, and in so doing, it has had to make some unusual arrangements. For one thing, the company is putting cleanup crews on 2 large Navy amphibious assault ships. So for the first time on these vessels, sailors and civilians are living and working together. Claire Richardson went on board the USS Fort McHenry and has this report.
Alaskan folk artists performing on board an amphibious assault ship? Why, it's just another in a series of firsts the United States Navy has experienced while dealing with the nation's worst oil spill. The USS Fort McHenry was originally designed to carry more than 400 battle-ready Marines. But instead of the ship's landing crafts transporting soldiers, the Navy has spent the last month as a commuter service, ferrying crews to remote island beaches for the tedious cleanup of oil-coated shorelines. Commander George Rhodes says the Navy never intended women to live on board the Fort McHenry. But now, 80 of them are sleeping in quarters monitored by female security guards.
It's unique in that we have women living on board the ship. We're lucky in that the way we're designed, we're able to give them a completely separate berthing area with their own bathroom facilities. We had to learn to speak civilian jargon a little bit better, so they would find their way around. They didn't automatically know what port and starboard meant, so we had to be careful on that. Everybody seems to realize we're up here for a common purpose, so it's actually worked out quite well.
Several women, including Joan Daniels of Bird Creek, Alaska, say the sailors are often more polite than the men on the cleanup crews.
If you're going to go down the stairs, a naval man will always step aside and let you go. Where an Alaskan man will just plunge in there and know that you probably have a chainsaw and a boat of your own or drive a pickup truck and can handle yourself and, you know, don't mind going second.
A bigger problem, says Daniels, is cooking thousands of good meals a day while staying within the rigid military guidelines.
It's pretty hard when you're cooking with recipes from the Pentagon. Navy cooking and Alaskan cooking is a long way apart because, you know, we're real free-spirited, and when a halibut comes on board, we just go for it and fillet it and get ready to cook it, and they come down with an order from the Pentagon that just can't be done. There's no recipe for it, and the CIA is going to have to be called in, and I don't know what all. I mean, it's just crazy, you know, because the Alaskans want a certain kind of food, and they don't really care for tomato bouillon. I mean, you know, they're out on the beaches doing hard work in really severe conditions, and they're terribly, terribly hungry, and they can't get by on Spam with raisin sauce.
The Navy says even if the civilians weren't on board, the cold Alaskan weather would dictate that rations be increased by 10%. But now there are unlimited portions for everyone. The issue of pay is a touchy subject for some sailors. They earn, on average, anywhere from $14 to $20 a day, while the civilians earn that much per hour. One sailor said Exxon could do something to make the discrepancy easier for the low-paid Navy men to accept.
We should get some of it. If not that, they should issue each of us a credit card for good for a year for free gas. They can't pay us some of it.
Exxon officials say the company is still negotiating with the Navy on how much it will pay for the use of the two amphibious assault ships. Commander Rhodes says he estimates that the USS Fort McHenry costs as much as $200,000 per day to operate. The Fort McHenry is scheduled to leave Alaska the second week of June. The USS Mount Vernon will take its place in the oil spill war. For National Public Radio, I'm Claire Richardson in Valdez, Alaska.
It's been 3 months since the tanker Exxon Valdez spilled more than 11 million gallons of oil in Prince William Sound, Alaska. Exxon has hired thousands of people to clean up the spill, and thousands more have flocked to Valdez in search of high-paying jobs. The onslaught of people has tripled the tiny city's population, creating critical housing and sanitary problems. Claire Richardson of the Alaska Public Radio Network has this report.
Nicknamed the Little Switzerland of Alaska, Valdez is nestled at the base of towering mountains, a picture-perfect setting for tourists who flock to Alaska in the summer. But now it's the headquarters for oil spill cleanup coordination, with a population that has mushroomed from 3,000 to 10,000 people. Visitors who drive along the main road can see hundreds of makeshift camps made out of ragtag campers, tents, and plastic. These are the homes of many oil spill workers and the unemployed. Through subcontractors, Exxon has hired more than 9,000 people. Some are union workers, but the majority are non-union. Thousands are living on boats in Prince William Sound, but thousands more make up the support staff based on shore. And some union workers, such as Dan Elliott, were frustrated and angry that Exxon provided housing and food for their staff and non-union workers first, while the laborers had to sleep in tents or cars.
As far as living conditions, you wait in line to go to the phone, you wait in line to take a crap, you wait in line to take a shower, you pay $2 for a loaf of bread.
Union workers are earning $17 an hour plus overtime. They're operating under an Alyeska pipeline terminal maintenance agreement, signed long before the tanker Exxon Valdez caused the nation's worst oil spill. And according to Gary Bacon of NORCON, the union's director of labor relations, Exxon does not legally have to provide any housing or food.
And as such, it is very unusual to deviate from a contract. I think that a need was seen by Exxon, and they realized that the amount of pressure that was being put on the city of Valdez by the people in the area living in substandard conditions, they realized that something needed to be done, and they moved to accomplish that.
Exxon is building temporary housing for 1,300 workers. The company's top man in Valdez, Otto Harrison, said Exxon was at first unaware that union laborers working 12-hour shifts were homeless. Harrison said that's because many job applicants listed Valdez as their home in order to meet local hire requirements. Thousands of job seekers drove to Valdez, and to the city's dismay, some men brought their families. An Anchorage couple and their three children tried unsuccessfully to live in a 21-foot camper. With only a few showers, toilets, and laundromats around town, Lisa Bridges, pregnant with her fourth child, cared for the three youngsters. In the cramped kitchen, Bridges peeled carrots for the dinner salad and described the bleak living conditions.
The night before, you know, I had to go give my kids cold showers and listen to them scream. Anyways, you know, well, if you don't like it, why don't you just go home? And then I'm not just talking for me, it's just there's a lot of families. We were going to have to be apart the rest of the summer, you know, for a while this summer anyway, and so our point was to try to be together because it's hard on all of us being apart.
Bridges and her children went back to Anchorage. The father planned to stay on his oil spill job. The money was too good to turn down. When Exxon recently allotted 130 beds to the union, the sickest and those living in the worst conditions were chosen by their fellow workers to take the coveted spaces. Valdez Hospital Administrator Joy Keating says doctors have been treating a tremendous increase in cases of bronchitis, pneumonia, and strep throat. Keating says another even more dangerous health threat is the spread of disease because of unsanitary living conditions.
There is a risk, and we have a fear. There are areas that you can smell the raw sewage, areas that we know, you know, there's a substantial amount just being dumped on the ground, and that is at risk for typhoid.
During a recent city council meeting, Mayor John Devon said the housing and sanitation crisis could have a bigger impact on Valdez than the oil spill itself.
When we drove in today, I smelled that when we went through there, and I didn't know what it was, but I smelled it. And if that is the sewerage that's coming off of those campers that are out there, my friends, we have got a serious health problem in this community. And I'll tell you, if a disease breaks out there, this town is going to suffer for years to come, because once the word gets out, they used the word cholera, but it could be any number of things that can break out in a situation like that. Once that gets out, you can kiss tourism goodbye for a long time.
In an effort to keep thousands of job seekers out of Valdez, Exxon has moved its hiring center to Anchorage, Alaska's largest city. And the company has given Valdez more than $300,000 to buy portable toilets and showers and develop water and sewer lines for temporary camps. But there have been delays in getting camps online due to building code violations of hastily erected bunkhouses and a backlog in getting supplies. City manager Doug Griffin says Valdez will struggle with a housing crisis throughout the summer as the labor force continues to grow and basic services are stretched to the breaking point. For National Public Radio, I'm Claire Richardson in Valdez, Alaska.
It's All Things Considered. I'm Emil Guillermo.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Three separate oil spills have cleanup crews busy today in Texas, Rhode Island, and Delaware. Two spills occurred last night, one this morning. About 4:30 yesterday, a Greek tanker apparently struck a reef at the mouth of Narragansett Bay off Newport, Rhode Island. We'll have a report from Rhode Island in a moment.
At 6:30 last night, in the Houston Ship Channel, a Panamanian-registered vessel collided with a tugboat, pushing three barges. One of the barges was damaged and spilled about 250,000 gallons of heavy crude. An oil slick, 2 miles long and up to a mile wide, has been seen from the air, and authorities have closed an 8-mile stretch of the canal. There have been no reports of damage to fish and wildlife. Early this morning in the Delaware River, a tanker from Uruguay ran aground and spilled at least 1.6 million gallons of heavy oil. Pollution control workers were called to the scene just south of Claymont, Delaware, and skimming operations were begun. State environmental officials say the oil has not reached the river's shore.
More than 1 million gallons of heating oil has spilled out of the Greek tanker World Prodigy after the ship hit a well-marked reef off the coast of Newport, Rhode Island yesterday. All the beaches in Narragansett Bay have been closed, and bathers have been asked to stay in port while the cleanup proceeds. Andy Bowers reports from Newport.
So far, the World Prodigy spill has played out very differently from the Exxon Valdez incident in March. For one thing, the number two heating oil spilled in Rhode Island, while more toxic than crude oil, is lighter and easier to clean up. Sunny skies and choppy waters off Newport are also helping to limit damage, according to Coast Guard Captain Eric Williams.
It evaporates like a gasoline does. As a matter of fact, there's sunshine today. I imagine most of the oil that's out there will be gone by tomorrow.
Another contrast with the Valdez spill is the quick and visible response by the Bush administration. Interior Secretary Manuel Lujan and EPA Chief William Riley flew to Newport last night to inspect cleanup operations. A presidential spokesman said the administration obviously learned something from the Alaska situation and would do everything possible to respond to the Rhode Island spill. Right now, the Coast Guard is pumping the remaining 6 million gallons of heating oil from the World Prodigy, which has about a 200-foot gash on one side. Leaking has stopped, officials say, and pumping could go on for another 48 hours or so. The ship's master has told investigators that this was only his second trip through Rhode Island waters. The reef he struck is one used in the past as a landmark for America's Cup races. Captain Eric Williams says the master had not yet picked up a local navigator.
All ports in the United States have a local pilot, someone knowledgeable about the local waters, that they pick up outside the port before they enter. He picked up a pilot about 20 minutes after the ship grounded.
Drug and alcohol tests have so far proved negative for the master. Earlier today, he told Rhode Island's governor he simply made a mistake. Environmentalists have been watching the cleanup closely and are generally pleased. Trudy Cox is executive director of Save the Bay.
I think if they keep up the pace that they started, we'll be in pretty good shape. That's not to say that there won't be some damage to Narragansett Bay and to the inlets around Narragansett Bay, but it could have been, I think, a lot worse, and we're very, very pleased that the Coast Guard has done as well as it has.
Booms have been placed in the water around sensitive coastal areas to protect them from the oil, which has begun to wash up on a few beaches. The state will reportedly convene a grand jury to investigate the incident. For National Public Radio, I'm Andy Bowers in Newport, Rhode Island.
The Exxon Valdez was towed out of Alaskan waters today, heading 3,000 miles south for dry dock repairs in San Diego. The tanker was trailing a new sheen of oil. The Coast Guard described it as a small amount. An Exxon official said it was nothing serious. It's been 3 months since the tanker spilled more than 10 million gallons of oil into Prince William Sound. At that time, few expected the spill to reach Kodiak Island, more than 300 miles away. But it has, and the salmon fishing season there has been delayed. Kodiak is one of the nation's richest fisheries, and salmon brings in the most money. Exxon has agreed to pay for losses resulting from the spill, but in order to get the compensation, the fishers may have to fish, even if they don't want to. Charlene Parent has been following the story for member station KMXT in Kodiak.
They don't want to go out, for one, because they can oil their gear. It's you can ruin a $30,000 net if you get one blob of oil in it. More importantly, they don't want to go out just because they're worried about the public perception of Alaska salmon, and they don't want the public to be concerned about the quality of their seafood. They'd rather just not fish this year so the public is feel secure and they can just clean up the island this summer.
How much oil actually is around Kodiak Island?
Well, I don't think we can calculate that. No one can calculate that. Very little of it has been picked up. It's different kind of oil than was in Prince William Sound. It's a weathered form of oil. It's like a roofing tar. So it's difficult to pick up. It's not something that can be skimmed off the water. It's generally just hitting the beaches, and people try and pick it up off the beaches in this tar-type form of oil. And if they don't get it up, the tide takes it out again, and it re-oils another beach. So the cleanup effort has to be different here than it was in Prince William Sound. It's more a beach cleanup effort.
Well, is this going to be a normal fishing season in Kodiak then?
Oh, not at all. Not anywhere near normal. It's going to mean boats crowding into small spots to fish because much of the island is closed to fishing. There is one district open right now to people who fish from the beach. None of the boats are out yet. They're keeping an eye on the oil contamination, and they'll open them as they can. But that means all the boats crowding into one area rather than being spread over the whole district. And that can be dangerous. You have hundreds of boats in a small lagoon piling nets over each other, and that's a real concern.
Do you think that some fishermen simply won't go out and fish because they are too concerned about the risks that might be involved this year? Maybe the compensation isn't even worth it.
Well, I don't know that the compensation isn't worth it. People have boat payments to make. They have to they have to have income some way. I don't think they want to jeopardize not getting the compensation, but they may try and get around this so-called good faith effort at fishing by perhaps going out once and showing good faith by fishing one opening and then hanging up their nets and going off to work cleanup, if they can do that under this agreement, which I'm not sure they can. They may boycott the whole fishery. I don't know if that will happen, but there has been talk of just not showing up for the fishery this year. It's hard to say right now. If they can go out once and satisfy the requirement for good faith fishing, they would do that, but I'm not sure if they can.
How does this affect the rest of the community, those who are not fishers?
Well, when you live in a fishing town, pretty much everyone's affected. The entire economy is based on fishing, so it's not just the fishermen that are hurting right now. The businesses hurt because people don't have money to buy goods, then the businesses will hurt. The cannery works are hurting. The cannery workers are hurting because if there's no fish, there's no jobs and there's no money. The native people who live on subsistence, who should be putting away food for the winter right now, are not doing that. That's an incalculable loss. And then the stress on the community is quite intense. The uncertainty, it's a difficult situation for everybody, not just the fishermen.
Charlene Parent of member station KMXT in Kodiak, Alaska. I have here in my hand a vial that's filled with sand, water, and an oily sludge. Wouldn't mistake this for Chanel. It's a sample of the waters of Prince William Sound, where the Exxon tanker Valdez ran aground this spring. Now, this hermetically sealed souvenir is one of several that are being marketed by entrepreneurs after the nation's worst oil spill. Since that March 24th disaster, other companies have marketed oil spill memorabilia, some for profit, some to raise funds for the cleanup. NPR's Carol Levinson reports that the task's not been easy.
Would you buy something like this as a souvenir?
No. I think it's disgusting looking.
Would you buy a product like this either as a souvenir or something to remind you of what can
happen? No, I don't think I would.
Why not?
I would want it to remind me of that. That was a terrible tragedy that happened. I would definitely buy something like that, if nothing else. Hey, have it out there. But myself included, I don't know if I'd quite want to go $15.
Oil in a bottle produced by Alaska Resource Samples will retail for between $10 and $15. Don Locker is a Seattle-area developer who, since the Exxon spill, no longer describes himself as a rabid anti-environmentalist. Now a founding partner in Alaska Resource Samples, he defends the price of the product, saying it's expensive to collect oil and package it in EPA-approved plastic-sealed vials. Anyway, Locker never intended to market his product to consumers. Initially, he sent free samples to environmental groups and members of Congress, but he received no response. Jim Stratton, vice president of the Alaska Conservation Foundation, a funding organization for environmental projects, says Locker should not be discouraged by this early rejection.
The market for this kind of thing is just the general public, and that's where this kind of a product needs to be placed, is in, you know, in gift stores and variety stores and specialty stores all over the states, so that just Joe average citizen can have a chance to purchase something like that. And I think that's what their market is, and it's not environmental groups in Congress.
Whatever the market, Stratton hopes it's big. At least $1 from the sale of every bottle is headed to the foundation's Prince William Sound Cleanup and Rehabilitation Fund. Both Stratton and Locker expect to sell 500,000 bottles to raise at least $500,000 for the fund over the next couple of years. So far, Alaska Resource Samples has sold about 17,000 bottles, some to educational groups and recently to Greenpeace, and they are popular items on Alaska cruise ships. But Locker wants his product to raise consciousness as well as money as a tangible reminder of how oil companies can harm the environment.
What we're hoping is that when it comes time to vote on the offshore drilling in California and Washington, Oregon, and when the oil companies start pursuing all this offshore drilling, that people have seen it, they know what it looks like, and they'll say, you know, maybe I don't really want all that drilling and that pollution on my beaches.
Locker says, of course, Exxon has not been eager to help promote his message.
My attitude is that Exxon doesn't really want the public to see this. They don't. it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. Once the oil sinks and nobody sees it anymore and they get it kind of cleaned up, then everybody will just kind of forget about it. And it's not really that way. That oil is going to be on the bottom of that ocean for a long, long time.
Lucker also alleges Exxon has tried to undermine his company's efforts to collect oil by threatening Alaska Resource Samples workers. Exxon spokesman Henry Bethert in Valdez emphatically denies the charge.
The only thing that we have done is fail to help some of these people collect oil. And we basically said we're real busy cleaning up the oil spill. If you are able to collect some oil and put it in little bottles and sell it, well, that's fine with us.
Alaska Resource Samples' intentions to educate the public are serious, but not completely. Don Locker reads the message on the back of the yellow card attached to the bottle.
Warning in the back is keep out of the reach of children because it is semi-toxic. The other warning is do not drive tanker while intoxicated. That was our fun and joke. We didn't really, our goal was not to go out and put Exxon all over this and create a vendetta against Exxon. Our goal is to just let people see and let them decide, make their own decision.
People should be able to make their own decision soon. The Alaska Resource Samples product is being sold at trade shows throughout the country this summer and is expected to be in the stores in the lower 48 this fall. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson.